Rich Savin Williams, hello. Thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Good to be here.
I wanted to have you on for a couple reasons. First, it is Pride Month here in Toronto, and I know there's a new study out that talks about human sexuality, specifically in sort of young adult males. And I know you recently had a new book out called Mostly Straight. And I'm curious, the conclusions that you reach in the book seem very similar to what Alfred Kinsey talked about in the 50s and 60s. How much of what you describe could be considered an extension of that type of thinking?
Well, certainly I would agree with Kinsey 100% that sexuality is on a continuum and that there are many points along the way. And it's true not only in terms of sexual arousal and sexual identity, but also in terms of romantic arousal and romantic identity. So it's less categorical than it is a spectrum. And this is true not only for women, which we've recognized for some time, but I believe now also for men. And we're beginning to document that.
Why do you think it's taken us longer to talk about male sexuality than it is about female sexuality? Is there a certain stigma associated with being a man that is different than maybe how women identify and orient themselves?
I do believe so. My sense is that for many decades, women are okay if they recognize, or if other people recognize, that they have a small degree, say, of same-sex attractions. So they're not totally exclusively straight. But our perception of men, and I think of men themselves, is that if they have any little bit of same-sex attractions, then they are gay. And I think that has been a real handicap from them admitting or recognizing and certainly naming that little bit of same-sex attractions. Now, that degree of same-sex attractions can obviously go from 1% all the way to 100%. And I think it's the middle ground, which we sort of don't allow men in a very significant way to attribute to themselves.
It strikes me that it's only been within the last 100, 150 years that we've really started having a negative view of homosexuality. You look in, you know, even like Shakespeare or Da Vinci or a lot of people that may have said to have homosexual urgings, and people really brush them off. I find that maybe it wasn't until Oscar Wilde that we really started talking about it. How do you rate where we are with homosexuality now versus how it was perceived and talked about all those years ago?
Well, I'm not a historian, so I don't want to make too strong claims, but I think it's very clear that there have always been men who have some degree of same-sex attractions, whether that's been a dominant pattern or whether it's been only a slight amount. But there was never a name attached, or at least if there was a name attached, it was very little known, or it was only for a very select group. So what has happened certainly more recently is that we've begun to name it. And I think in a sense, when you begin to name it, then you can begin to attribute characteristics to that person. In other words, it doesn't become an attribute of the person, it becomes the person himself. And so he becomes homosexual, or he becomes gay, or bisexual. So I think our willingness to let loose of a little bit of that. So in some ways, what I would be advocating is almost going back in history. That is, that I don't see real progress going forward if we continue to identify people by categories or labels. I think we've been in that point of view now for many years, but I think maybe the future which I believe very much that young people have already moved there, is to think less in terms of categories and more in terms of characteristics of the person, just as they can be relative degree of attractiveness or outgoingness or whatever characteristic. I think now young people are beginning to recognize that sexuality is the same, so that if you say, I'm gay, that really doesn't say very much about your personality or how you look, who you're attracted to, or who you fall in love with.
So it's something where we're seeing a lot of young celebrities, mainly female, but also some males as well, saying, I'm not going to identify as bi or pan or gay or whatever, because I just want to fall in love with the person. And now people are saying that they're sapiosexual. So are you advocating for something along the lines of that?
Well, in my ideal world, we wouldn't even have those kinds of labels at all. You know, there is a growing awareness of many different kinds of identities or categories, pansexual, asexual, a wide range. Maybe that's part of the process that we need to get through, that first we have only two labels, and then we have three labels, then we have five labels, and then we have a dozen. But where I would eventually like to get to is to where we don't have labels, that people can just be who they are. And I think it was the actor Lee Pace who said, when he was asked a question, are you gay? He basically said, I've dated men and I've dated women. And you see, that's the kind of terms that I sort of like. He's describing, you know, he's dated men and he's dated women, without trying to say that means I'm bisexual.
Right.
He just used descriptives. And I think that's what we probably are moving toward.
I've been turned on to this idea recently of sexual orientation versus sexual orientation identity. Do you see a difference between orientation and identity at all?
Yes. For me, the distinction is that sexual orientation pretty much is something that you are born with. You don't freely choose. It's just who you are. That is the degree to which you are attracted, and that can be sexually or romantically, to men, women, neither, both, or some wide range. On the other hand, the identity is the more public kind of term that you use to convey that knowledge in a way that you want to other people. So that obviously one can be gay totally by sexual orientation, but straight by sexual identity. That is, you don't have to tell the truth, and you may not even be aware of what your sexual feelings or romantic feelings actually mean in terms of an identity. And that's especially true, of course, for young people growing up.
There's a lot of talk recently about sexual identity and sexual attraction versus that of romantic identity and romantic attraction. How for people who, you know, who don't study this fully, how would you describe the differences between those two worlds, if at all?
Well, usually, and that's a, you know, vague term, they are identical. That is, the gender that you have sexual desire for is the same gender that you desire to fall in love with. But what is very critical is that they are not always the same. So yes, they're highly correlated, but there are certainly people who might be exclusively sexually attracted to one gender, but then have some romantic feelings towards the other. I've also interviewed young men who are sexually turned on by one gender, but romantically fall in love with the other. That is, I've interviewed a man who totally watches gay porn, but falls in love with women. And I've had another guy who romantically falls in love with guys, but is sexually attracted to women. So those are extreme cases. But it does highlight, I believe, the the sense to which they don't necessarily have to be identical. And of course, there is some research in terms of neurological research which shows that even though sexual and romantic desires, arousals, are located somewhat in the same place in the brain, they're not absolutely overlapping.
In the last few years, we've seen a lot more awareness of asexual people, and I have some friends here in the community in Toronto who identify as such. But in terms of what we were going back to earlier about, you know, sexual identity and orientation, where would you put asexual people on that vast spectrum?
Well, with asexual individuals, and I would say the same thing with aromantics, is that it is certainly possible to have no sexual desires and or no romantic desires, period. It's also possible to have a slight amount. So even with some asexuals, they will say, well, I'm not totally 100% asexual. And some people have use the term gray sexual or gray romantic to indicate that it is possible, not maybe heavily likely. So I think asexuality is also on a continuum from zero to a teeny bit, if you will.
So I'm very curious because, you know, your book definitely talks about maybe reworking the ideas around male sexuality. And with this sort of cultural movement that we're in with Me Too, Time's Up, and the dismantling, if you will, of the patriarchy and the toxic masculinity, how do you think that the conversation around male sexuality can be related to that conversation that we're having?
I think that if we were to allow men, if you will, to be in touch, to be aware, to recognize their femininity, both in terms of gender and also in terms of attractions, that perhaps we would have a less male ego invested in proving his sexuality. And I think that would be a positive. I think in any way that we can begin to break down these hard lines, these egos, these masculine egos, is a good thing. And one thing that I definitely found with mostly straight and sexually fluid young men is that they are more likely to be feminist and more likely to be pro-gay, even if they only have a little bit of same-sex attractions or romantic desires. And I think the real key there is that they are more in touch with their own emotions, their own inner self. And I think that that is a good thing. I hope it plays itself out, of course, in real life. But I think there's a real good possibility that it would be a step in the right direction for our culture to take.
Along that note, do you find that the reverse is true, that those who are the most viciously and violently homophobic and have sort of the big macho egos about themselves towards masculinity tend to be the ones that have more same-sex attraction but don't want to publicly identify as such?
I would say certainly there are such individuals, but I do not see when I read the literature that has been shown to be the case. I think there are other things going on beside their sexuality that makes them so extreme. But I don't believe that we could assume that the most homophobic guys are actually gays in disguise or rejecting their same-sex attractions. Though I will say some are, but I get no sense that one could make that jump.
I mentioned that it's Pride Month here, and in terms of having discussions about sexuality and sexual identity and even gay rights as a whole, where do you think we are with Pride now versus when it started 30, 40 years ago?
Well, I think that certainly back then, we needed to establish very clearly that we exist and we have rights. And I think that that was a critical time period. I think it achieved many, many, many of its objectives. I think now that pride for us will basically mean accepting the spectrum of sexual romantic attractions and of individuals, and to recognize that this movement is much broader than we perhaps ever imagined. If you just think for a moment about, you know, how few identifiable gay and bisexual men there was that participated. Now that has probably doubled or tripled if you could recruit all of those people to attend and to participate in Pride events.
I think the other thing that I've noticed that's not talked about is that people can still be critical of the fact that Pride and these types of events are still very white, very Caucasian. How can we advance the conversation and have dialogue with about sexuality within minority communities, whether they're African American, Asian, Latino, etc.?
Well, I think part of this is some of the same kind of dynamic, which is if we begin to open our eyes to many possibilities, I think that individuals who are not white in those communities who maybe find it more difficult at times to be totally gay or totally lesbian or whatever, would be more likely to feel as if they could participate, that Pride was for them, because they may have particular difficulties or particular issues involved in being out in their community. And I think if we took a less hard stance about what it means to be gay or lesbian or bisexual, then I think that we would be a more welcoming community and a more inclusive one. At least that would be my hope.
You mentioned young people earlier, and it's definitely noticed that young people are, you know, pro-gay marriage. They don't really care who you sleep with, whereas a lot of the older generations are maybe still struggling with that a little bit more. Why do you think it's difficult for some people to change, and why do you think the younger generations are so much more open to sexuality and discussions about such?
Well, I think that in their world, and there is an increase, a dramatic increase. It's difficult for us to even imagine the extent to which that sexual and gender diversity is mainstream in their world. So that when you actually look at some polling data, you find essentially, you know, up to 80 or 85% of young people are supportive of the rights of gender and sexual minority individuals. Why is that the case? I think that there's no doubt that Hollywood, sports, films, movies, singers who have come out, who have declared their gender and sexual identities as being other than totally exclusively straight or male or female, has allowed these young people the models, but also the sort of the pathways and the trajectories by which they don't have to be what I would call maybe adult culture or mainstream culture says that they have to be. And of course, this gets communicated through social media, where anyone with any particular kind of unique sexual gender or romantic proclivity can find others like them, and so they can find support. And I think there's just this way in which this younger generation can find acceptance, and they know that they have peer support. They can find peer support, and it's not that difficult. And I think even, we'll say sort of politically and religiously conservative young people are also very supportive of of the rights of gender and sexual minorities. So it's not just a liberal cause, it's more of a generational cause. And I'm hoping, of course, that that continues, and certainly we'll see.
On that note, what would you say to those who in power who make laws, whether it's around sexual identity or age of consent laws, those who have the power to put these things in place? What would you say to them in regards to sexual identity and sexual orientation?
I would say to them to listen to the generations that will be following, and rather than trying to impose their adulthood, if you will, or their sense of adulthood onto people who will be living in the future. So they need to pay attention, they need to find out, they need to listen. And I find it somewhat appalling that so many adults, even sex researchers and people who should know better, don't really listen openly to what young people are telling us about what their world is like and what it will be like, therefore, in the future.
I know you've advocated for, let's call it the abolition of identity and labels, but what about other things such as age of consent laws? Because they've changed a lot over the last 10 or 15 years. And other maybe legal aspects of sex and sexual identity, do we still need those things in place as to protect a certain group of people, or should we do away with those as well?
I will say that that is sort of beyond my area of expertise. I certainly think we need to be flexible to rethink those kinds of issues legally and morally or ethically or whatever. I think that that becomes an issue which we have some very rigid views about in our culture. And I just think we ought to sort of take another look at some of those laws and some of those expectations and to rethink them to see whether or not they really are based on knowledge or prejudice. And I think that could be a very important step.
You mentioned that I think a lot of young people are much more open because of what we see on TV. You know, we've got Ellen DeGeneres, who's the top talk show host in the world. Will and Grace is now back on TV. One Life to Live, the reboot, all sorts of things like that. As someone who's studied this for years, when did you notice that shift happened? Was it gradual, or did it come all at once? Can you pinpoint a time and as to maybe when that became acceptable?
Well, yeah, I think everyone sort of has maybe their own moment in time. I will say that for me, that I sense that the world had really begun to change, or at least the world in terms of the U.S., is when Ellen came out on her program, and it was the most watched show that she had ever had. And even though corporate America withdrew some, many did not. And I think the response was so positive that it just became one of those things, those moments in our culture when it was, oh, something has changed here. And I'm not saying that she made the change. I think that Ellen made it very clear that this was happening, even though we sort of may not have been as aware of it as not. And I freely admit anyone else could think of another moment that was was critical. But it does seem to me that that was at least one of several big ones.
You know, given that there's, you know, that every second or third show has an LGBTQ character, is that maybe why you think we're seeing pushback from the older conservative religious community as a way to fight what they see as the saturation of our moral culture and our pop culture in a way, or are those two things not related at all?
Well, I think my sense is that the pushback is even less than it has ever been. So yes, there's still individuals who are uncomfortable with any change in what they see as sexual mores or traditions or patterns. But it seems to me that there just isn't that much pushback compared to the way that it used to be, where, I mean, it's more difficult to find conversion therapy, for example. Those are disappearing. They haven't totally, but there's certainly far, far fewer opportunities to try to convert your sexuality. I think parents are not nearly as sold on conversion therapies as they might have been at one time. So I think there's a way in which the information is getting out there that lead people to more willingly accept what's going on. And I think even, as I mentioned previously, some evangelical Christians have really made some progress, especially, of course, among the younger ones. I think that's true with some of the more right-wing Catholics and Jews and so forth. And Muslims, yeah, but maybe a little slower. But I do think that those kinds of things are certainly moving forward.
You know, there are a lot of churches in different denominations that are embracing, you know, gay members, gay, you know, bishops or whatever. But also I'm finding that the younger generation tends to be the least religious we've had in modern history. And do you see any correlation between religious belief or lack thereof and acceptance of the gay queer community?
Well, I do understand what you're saying, and I do think that maybe a better description of young people is that they are finding sort of spiritual value, but not so much in traditional institutions. So that many of them do have other religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs that are very helpful to them, are important, and give them a very firm foundation. And I think in large part it's because they find the institutions, the religious institutions, far less able to attend to their needs. They see the hypocrisy at times of the religious institutions, of what they say and what they do. And I think this has certainly led a lot of young people away from traditional religion. But I also recognize that it's also true that they are just less religious as well. I just want to give them credit for being spiritual and having a sense of that the importance of that for their lives without necessarily attaching that to institutional structures. Because I think that is probably one of the things that they certainly have moved away from big time.
So both with mostly straight and becoming who I am, what can that teach us about what it means to be a boy, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a male in today's society?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think my purpose in becoming who I am for young gay men was to tell the real stories of real gay guys growing up in today's world. That is, my intent there was to show their experiences that don't map onto the way that gay men might have had their lives while they were growing up. So they tell their story, and their stories are quite diverse in a many, many, many different ways. And in the same way, I wanted to show that mostly straight, by highlighting their lives, that there are many different ways of becoming mostly straight. And by that I mean there's many different expressions. Some of it is through sexual behavior or sexual desire or sexual arousal or romantic or whatever. And the third book, which I'm writing now, is on bisexual males. And I sort of almost hate to use the word bisexual in a way, because that one term encompasses a wide range of bisexuality, all the way from, you know, those who have just a little bit to ones of same-sex attractions to those who have a lot. Also, it highlights young men who are into kink, young men who are trans, who are thinking about transitioning to a woman. And so these are all individuals who sort of begin to break our perceptions or our stereotypes about what it means to be gay or bisexual or mostly straight. And I think this is what we have to do. We have to get these stories out, because I'm not so convinced that a lot of research in the past has helped us to understand that. Now, I think within the last year or two, that is finally beginning to change, where we are now beginning to listen to young people and the way that they experience their sexuality in a way that hopefully we will listen to.
Finally, what do you think the future holds in terms of conversations about sexuality, identity, orientation, and attraction?
Well, I think we will, in the future, and I hope this is true, separate those. Do not assume that they all mean the same thing or lead everyone in the same direction. That is, that we will understand that these things are diverse and that we won't sort of jump to conclusions in regard to what any one thing means for the others. And I think in many ways, what I would say is that young men today are sort of following in the footsteps of women, because I think for women, they have always been, or at least for many years, they have been able to lead these kinds of diverse lives. And I think in a way that a lot of people find rather interesting and rather exciting. And I just want to open those doors for young men as well, and to say that they have opened these doors, and I'm just trying to tell those stories and to make people aware of them.
Well, the newest book is Mostly Straight, Sexual Fluidity Among Young Men, and the previous one is Becoming Who I Am, Young Men on Being Gay, and we look forward to your next book whenever it comes out. Rich Seven Williams, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
You're welcome.
All right, have a good day. Cheers.
Okay, bye.